From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. And when the new Congress comes in, there will be a record number of women of color, 35 Democrats and 3 Republicans. One of those women, Pramila Jayapal, is the first Indian-American woman to be elected to the House of Representatives. Jayapal is a Democrat and will represent the 7th Congressional District in Washington State. She joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Well, I want to first ask you, because you won't be surprised to hear that most of the attention over the last several days has been about the president-elect, Donald Trump, and not the new members of Congress. But how do you see what's shaping up to be the Trump administration at this point? Are you concerned about somebody like Steve Bannon being the chief strategist for the president?
I am very concerned. I think we were all taking a breath to hope that perhaps President Trump would be different than candidate Trump. And I think we were all hoping for the best. But as you look at the transition team, as you look at some of the names mentioned, Bannon, we've also got, I think, a number of folks who are lobbyists for oil and gas companies that are on the transition team, the EPA potential nominees. I think these are all really troubling signs for us as we look forward.
Are you going to try to stop any of his nominations?
Well, I think that's the next stage, is really to figure out exactly what our levers of power are, given that we're in the minority in both the House and the Senate. And I think that there's no question that there's going to be vigorous defense. Exactly what shape that takes, I think, is still to be seen.
What's your agenda going to be as you come in a party that is not in power in the House?
Well, it's definitely not the way I wanted to come in. You know, I come from one of the most liberal, progressive districts in the country. Washington 7th is where Seattle is. We, in our state, just passed a statewide minimum wage increase, paid safe and sick days. We passed gun reform legislation for the second time in 3 years. We have an agenda that obviously is very different than what we may be able to accomplish. That said, there is an economic piece to a lot of the work that I've been doing. And I think that resonates with all voters, including some of those that voted for Trump. If you look at Arizona, what you see is a really interesting story that's maybe a little bit more complex than some of what we've covered in the last couple of days. And that is a state that went for Trump, that kicked out Sheriff Joe Arpaio, something that I worked very hard on over the years, and also passed a statewide minimum wage increase. So I'm going to be looking for those opportunities to really address the needs of working families, whether it's increasing the minimum wage, whether it's an infrastructure package. Both of those are things that candidate Trump did speak about.
Right.
And I also think that we need to look at a lot of the issues that women in this country are facing, things like affordable child care and paid safe and sick days. Those are things, I think, where there might be some possibility to move. But I also think that we have to be very clear that we are going to have some major fights. And I've never been afraid of a fight. I'm certainly not backing down now to make sure that we protect constitutional rights and civil rights for all people.
And by the way, you mentioned Joe Arpaio. There's been some talk that he may end up in the Trump administration.
He is one of the ones that gives me such heartburn, you know, to even float his name as a possible DHS or immigration official in power is just horrifying to me. And Donald Trump, before he became a candidate, was not opposed to immigration reform. But who he surrounds himself with, who he puts on his short list, and who he puts on the transition team are very good indicators and of what he's going to be like as a president and who he's going to give power to. And that is of deep, deep concern.
You were endorsed by Bernie Sanders in your race. Do you think he would have won if he had run against Trump?
It's very hard to say. And, you know, we are not at that point anymore. I endorsed Bernie and Bernie endorsed me. I think many of those working people who either didn't vote or voted for Trump may have voted for Bernie Sanders. But I think the most important thing that we have to think about now is how do we bring that very strong working class message to people across this country and win back the hearts and minds of people, even as we're facing these deep, you know, rollbacks of some of the things we fought so hard for. So I think Senator Sanders' message and the work that I've been doing in my district and in my state is absolutely the agenda that we need to be pursuing in a very strong way. And we need to be standing up for that agenda unapologetically. And I think, you know, when you have a contradiction of say, talking about, you know, being the party that fights for the working class, but then at the same time, you know, are not willing to take on trade policies that leave workers behind or some of the populist things that both Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders talked about in very different ways, then I think, you know, we have a problem. So we've got some work to do. I think we are going to have to regroup, and we're going to have to really look at how we address class, race, and gender, all of which were very present in this election.
On the other hand, there are some in your party who would say there's a risk of going too far to the left after this because Democrats could be painted just as a party that will raise taxes to increase spending hugely on social programs.
That is always the argument against taking on really strong, and I'm not even going to call them progressive platforms, because frankly, I don't think that raising the minimum wage or even keeping it consistent with inflation over the last many years is something that should be considered progressive or radical. It is taking care of people and making sure that as our economy grows, that everybody gets to grow with it.
So I grew up in the Midwest, in the middle of Illinois, and for my entire life, I have had a lot of Indian American friends. They just have been in high school and college and beyond. And now, does it surprise you that you're the first Indian American woman to be elected to the House of Representatives, that there aren't already more?
Well, it's always a surprise to me how little diversity we seem to have in elected office. You know, I served as the only woman of color in the state Senate in Washington State, a state that is quite blue. It is an incredible honor. I'm so proud to be able to blaze this path and really show Indian American women across this country that they too have an opportunity, but not only Indian Americans. I mean, I think that there are so many different communities that need to be represented in politics. And I'm also proud that, you know, we're electing Vietnamese American women and Somali American women to the state legislature in Minnesota in that case. This is important not just because of what our skin color is or because, you know, there's some outward experience, but because when we chair a hearing, when we craft legislation, when we listen to testimony and decide what is important and what isn't, our experience really does matter. And we do speak for a number of people who often are not at the table in the crafting of legislation.
That's Congresswoman-elect Pramila Jayapal of the 7th District in Washington, the first Indian American woman to be elected to the House of Representatives. Congresswoman-elect, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, thousands of firefighters are battling wildfires across the South today, some of the biggest in North Carolina and Georgia, where the Rough Ridge Fire has been burning in tinder-dry forests for nearly a month now. Other fires are burning in Kentucky, South Carolina, Tennessee. Sam Whitehead is a reporter at Here and Now contributor Georgia Public Broadcasting. He's in Atlanta. Sam, what is going on in Georgia?
Well, Robin, as you mentioned, there are these wildfires burning kind of all across the southeast right now. If you want to picture the southern Appalachian Mountains, that's really where the epicenter of all this is. The U.S. Forest Service tells me we've got 37 fires burning in the southeast right now, and that's about 100,000 acres on fire. Mm-hmm. So we've got the largest, the Rough Ridge Fire here in North Georgia. That's right at about 20,000 acres, and at this point is only about 25% contained.
And is it because of drought and dry weather?
That is really the main factor. These are really drought-driven. Most of North Georgia has been in an extreme drought for a while, and that means there's a lot of dry fuel out there for these fires once they take hold to spread and really make them hard to fight. So yeah, drought's really the main cause right now.
And we know that in Kentucky there have been some arson arrests, people causing brush fires by defying burn bans in the drought. So there's human incidents on top of the drought. But we're also seeing pictures of people wearing masks, and we know in Macon County, North Carolina, health masks were issued over the weekend because the smoke is so strong.
And I'm not seeing folks wearing masks here in Atlanta, but we are definitely seeing and smelling the smoke. I mean, I'm kind of right in downtown Atlanta, and our skyline was pretty badly obscured yesterday. The smoke was so thick. I was talking with a colleague in Macon, too. You know, I'm about 100 miles south of this biggest fire. Macon's about 200 miles, and they were even seeing and smelling the smoke down there yesterday. So we're pretty far from this fire, but we're still feeling the effects
right
here in Atlanta.
Well, and you point out that some health officials have said what about these masks?
Yeah. So, you mentioned these dust masks. These are what you might be able to buy at a hardware store. The Georgia Department of Public Health has actually issued a specific warning saying these might seem like they could help you, but the particulate matter that's in this wildfire smoke is actually so fine that these dust masks are not going to do much good. Mm-hmm. So the Georgia Department of Public Health is really just encouraging people to limit any strenuous outdoor activity until this smoke subsides, which they're expecting to happen later this week.
Boy, Sam, a lot of firefighters from across the country have come there to help California firefighters in the South. I mean, just briefly, are people there just, you know, what's going on? This is not usual.
Yeah, I mean, the main reaction that I'm seeing and hearing down in the city of Atlanta is just kind of surprise. I was born here in Metro Atlanta, grew up here, and have no memory of us really having any awareness of fires in North Georgia. So it's just kind of shock and surprise that these events, which are not uncommon in North Georgia this time of year, that we're actually seeing the impacts down here, you know, so far away in the city of Atlanta.
Yeah. Sam Whitehead with Georgia Public Broadcasting. Sam, thank you.
Thank you.
There have been a number of disturbing incidents since the election. A West Virginia official says she's apologized and been put on leave for sending out a racially charged tweet. After seeing a picture of Melania Trump and Michelle Obama at the White House, the Clay County Development Corporation Director, Pamela Ramsey Taylor, tweeted, "It will be refreshing to have a classy, beautiful, dignified First Lady. I'm tired of seeing an ape in heels." To which the Clay mayor replied, "That made my day." In Silver Spring, Maryland, there's a $10,000 reward for information about graffiti on a church sign advertising a Spanish-language mass. The graffiti said, "Trump Nation, whites only." And yesterday, the FBI reported a big increase in hate crimes in the year before this election, with a 67% surge in crimes against Muslims in 2015. But there have also been recent attacks on Trump supporters. Police are investigating a beating by two black men of a white Chicago man after a minor car accident. Bystanders reportedly shouting, "He voted for Trump." Mark Potok is senior fellow for the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligence Project. He's in Montgomery, Alabama. Mark, what are you seeing since the election?
Well, we have seen a real spate of hate crimes and even more hate incidents, things that don't really rise to the level of crimes. But, you know, enormous numbers of reports of women having their hijabs torn off, of Muslim kids being bullied in schools, of black people being shouted at by white people or attacked in more serious ways, along with shouts of Trump won, that kind of thing. A black church was burned to the ground in the Mississippi Delta, and "Vote Trump" was left spray painted on the side. So there really been an enormous amount of these kinds of incidents. We've been running a count, and as of last night, we were up to about 435 incidents around the country.
Well, in Massachusetts, letters were sent to the homes of people in one town saying that blacks had been banned in that town. But when you say some incidents, some rise to the level of crime, remind us, what's the difference?
Well, a hate crime is actually a crime, a pre-existing crime, you know, an aggravated assault, a murder, vandalism, those kinds of things. Typically, what makes it a hate crime is simply when a hate crime penalty enhancement phase is added to the trial. And basically, the criteria is simply, was the crime motivated mostly or wholly by animus towards a particular group of people based on things like sexual orientation, skin color, ethnicity, national origin, religion, and so on.
When you talk about things like people getting letters saying that they're no longer allowed in their town, or somebody shouting at kids, "Muslims go home," is that free speech or is that a crime?
Well, generally, it's free speech. I mean, you know, the exceptions to free speech are a criminal incitement, which is a very, very narrow band of actions, and a true threat. A true threat is a phrase from the law which means a threat that would be taken seriously by a reasonable third party. So, you know, I would say in the majority of cases, saying something like "Muslims go home" really does not amount to a crime.
But others do. At St. David's Episcopal Church in Bean Blossom, Indiana, there was vandalizing over the weekend, a swastika, an anti-gay slur, and the words "Heil Trump." And some other incidents have had certain numbers left at the scene. What are those numbers and what do they mean to you? One is 88.
Well, there are two numbers that are symbols very widely used of the white supremacist movement, really the kind of neo-Nazi part of the white supremacist movement, 14 and 88. 14 refers to the so-called 14 words. These were written by a man, David Lane, who died in prison serving a 190-year sentence for the assassination of a Jewish talk show host. The 14 words are, "We must secure the existence of our people and a future for white children." 88, because H is the eighth letter in the alphabet, is taken to stand for HH, which in turn stands for Heil Hitler. So it's a kind of signature that's used very widely by neo-Nazis and other white supremacists in the United States and abroad.
And are you seeing that post-election?
A little bit. I mean, that has not been the dominant kind of report we've seen. We've seen a fair number of reports of swastikas, lots and lots of anti-black racial graffiti, as well as graffiti aimed at Muslims and other minorities.
Yeah, there's graffiti like Black Lives Matter doesn't count and neither does your vote. Well, on 60 Minutes on Sunday, Donald Trump was asked about this increase that you and others are seeing in hate crime since the election. Here's what he said.
I am so saddened to hear that. And I say, stop it. If it helps, I will say this, and I'll say it right to the camera, stop it.
Mark Potok, again, of the Southern Poverty Law Center, your thoughts when you heard that?
Well, it's mighty fine of Donald Trump to make that statement now after the election, but the fact is that he has been stoking this kind of hatred directly for something like 18 months since he began his campaign in the middle of last year. You know, I think it's important to remember that this is a man who stood in front of crowds of 10, 12, 15,000 people and urged people to commit violence against protesters at those rallies. On several occasions, in fact, he suggested that he would pay the legal defenses of his supporters who beat up protesters at his rallies.
Well, what do you say to supporters of Trump who feel equally attacked? They cite the attack we mentioned in Chicago. There are other incidents where anti-Trump graffiti has been left. You know, what would you say?
Well, first of all, I think it is true that Trump supporters are also being attacked, I think pretty clearly at a lower level than Trump opponents. But in any case, yes, that is absolutely happening. You know, so I think there's a difference in scale, but certainly there is violence on both sides.
Mark Potok of the Southern Poverty Law Center, thank you as always.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, a pastor in Silicon Valley is trying to do something about one aspect of what we're seeing. Pastor Ron Buford is leading a 12-step approach to recovering from racism. It was born from his own experience of being racially profiled. And the solution, he believes, is gathering people from different races and getting them to talk openly about their prejudices. Farida Javala Romero from Here and Now contributor KQED begins our story at one of Pastor Buford's meetings.
I'm Ron, and I'm a racist.
I'm Morgan, and I'm a racist.
I'm Josie, and I'm a racist.
10 people take turns introducing themselves at a racist anonymous meeting at the Congregational Church of Sunnyvale. Pastor Ron Buford says the first step, like with any addiction, is acknowledging you have a problem, taking responsibility.
Racism in the world is real. We should stop being in denial about it, the way an alcoholic is in denial about alcoholism. And we should say, yep, we're racist, and we're working on it.
It was very difficult to say, essentially, hi, my name is Casey, and I'm a racist.
Casey Ream remembers his first meeting a couple of months ago. He's 26 and white.
It made me feel humility. It made me feel embarrassed. But it also made me feel like, okay, if these other people are not going to lash out at me right now after saying that, if they're going to say it too, then maybe this is a good starting place.
Saying you're a racist in this group means that you've treated someone differently because of how they look. That broad definition levels the playing field so that people have a common starting point to examine their prejudices and stereotypes.
I'm in a situation where there are a number of black people, and some of them have these weird names.
Bonnie, who didn't want to use her full name, is a former kindergarten teacher.
And somehow, I just can't remember those weird names. And I feel very bad about it. And I can't
Josie, who's black, responds from across the circle.
On weird names, you might want to use unique or different, because I don't think the mother would like you to say, child has a weird name. Where'd you get Shaniqua?
Pastor Buford, who is also black, says he confessed his own stereotype to the group during a meeting. Asian women as bad drivers.
Where does that come from? You know, it's unscientific, it's racist, and it has no place in the 21st century.
Most of the stories are very personal, and some are loaded with guilt, anger, even pain. Daryl Alford talks about what happened to him decades ago, when he was walking home from school as a first grader.
A little white boy comes and slugs me in the stomach and calls me the N-word. And I'd never known anything about prejudice or hatred. I never heard that word at home.
Alford says he hadn't really talked about it before. Today's meeting was about step 9, make amends to people you've hurt or offended. Alford wishes that kid was around to make amends with him. But at this point, he's finally letting it go.
Just thinking about forgiveness, I guess I wanted to also say I do forgive him for what he did to me.
People here want to move on from grudges and regret to be more aware of how they treat others, says Casey Ream, the 26-year-old. Recently, he realized he was the only white person among Latinos at a convenience store and caught himself feeling uncomfortable.
That's like at the root of the problem, is being uncomfortable with someone based on their race or having feelings that we're separate or different or that we can't have that shared space, that community that we're all hungry for. So at those moments, I just open up and I smile and I'm glad to present myself as part of the mix.
The 12th step is to share the message with other, quote, race addicts. And Racist Anonymous is expanding. Two churches in North Carolina and Florida have begun groups as well. For Here and Now, I'm Farida Jabala Romero.
Securities and Exchange Commission Chairwoman Mary Jo White says she will step down at the end of the Obama administration, which means President-elect Trump will get to name her successor. So what does that mean for the SEC? Jason Bellini of The Wall Street Journal joins us from New York. Hi, Jason.
Hi, Jeremy.
And let's start with our terms here. What is the SEC? What do they do?
The SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, their primary responsibilities is enforcing federal securities laws. So we're talking about the nation's stock and option exchanges. We're also talking about all the people who are involved in the financial industry, the security industry. You have your brokers, your dealers, your investment advisors, mutual funds. Another big job of the SEC is promoting disclosure, making sure market-related information gets out to the public and that there's fair dealing and protecting against fraud.
Hmm. So what did Mary Jo White do during her tenure at the SEC?
During her tenure, Mary Jo White, she was a career prosecutor. So she aggressively pursued enforcement actions. And she also, during her tenure, was tasked with implementing the Dodd-Frank Regulatory Act. And so she was in the process of doing that. And it's been a complicated effort in this vast law after the 2008 financial meltdown. She's in that role. She's not been able to do a few things that she was hoping to, the main one being regulating pay for corporate executives. That was going to be tied into what she was doing. And that's the kind of thing that may go away under a Trump administration.
Well, what else might happen now that Trump is going to be able to pick the successor to Mary Jo White as commissioner of the SEC? What are people thinking the consequences will be?
Consequences? Well, President-elect Trump promised that he would either eliminate or sharply cut back the 2010 Dodd-Frank financial law. And his financial team has already issued a statement saying that it's going to do just that, though it's not said whether that's going to be part of the first 100-day agenda. But the agency will be completing rules that standardize how derivatives are traded and how, again, executive compensation will be handled. And it's most likely that under Republican leadership, some of those proposals inside the law will not get traction.
So it sounds like less regulation for Wall Street is ahead regardless.
Right, and less demonization of Wall Street itself. I think that's one of the the ideas that Donald Trump is bringing here is that we don't need to be attacking Wall Street itself. They've become the boogeyman in the view of many conservatives, and they think that's unfortunate.
And Jason, there is talk now of Wall Street people, former investment bankers, as possible Treasury Secretary.
Possible Treasury Secretary, yes. And, you know, they haven't named anyone yet. One person whose name we're hearing is Jeb Hensarling. And he's a big foe of financial regulation. He's a Texas Republican congressman, and he's known for his very sharp criticism of the 2010 Dodd-Frank law. He's been one of the leading critics of the U.S. Export-Import Bank, which finances American exports. He's really for deregulation, and we don't know whether he's going to get that job. There are other names in contention, but he's the type of candidate that's being considered right now.
Also, former Goldman Sachs partner Steven Mnuchin in being talked about. Jason Bellini of The Wall Street Journal, thank you.
Thank you.
President Obama is in Greece today on his last foreign trip as president. For the past 6 years, Greece has been working on overhauling its economy, imposing tax increases, budget cuts, and austerity measures in exchange for economic bailouts. It has also been at the forefront of the migrant crisis in Europe. At a joint press conference today, Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras was asked about the future of relations with President-elect Donald Trump. Here he is speaking through an interpreter.
Contrary to some of my colleagues in Europe, I did not rush to repeat some of the criticism that many of us have made during the election period about Donald Trump.
Kyriakos Mitsotakis is the head of Greece's center-right opposition party, New Democracy, and he could be the next prime minister. He joins us now from Athens. Mr. Mitsotakis, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And as we watch President Obama in Athens today, I wonder how you and other Greeks are reacting to the election of Donald Trump.
Look, we fully respect the will of the American people. The United States is a strong, prosperous country. The relationship between Greece and the United States is very strong, and we're looking forward to working with the new administration.
Do you think anything's going to change in the relationship?
Well, I think it's still early days. We're still, expecting, appointments by the president-elect. But I don't anticipate any substantial changes in the nature of the Greek-American relationship. I think we have made great progress in also changing the image of the United States in Greece. As we speak, the president, President Obama, is in Greece, and he has been a great friend and a great ally of Greece over those difficult 6 years that our country has faced a very significant economic crisis. I'm convinced that also with the new administration, we will find a strong ally.
Well, one of the storylines here in the United States right now is that President Obama is on a tour of Europe to reassure our allies about that things will be all right under President Trump. Is that how you see it, that it's a tour to reassure, or do you feel reassured?
Well, I presume that the United States' commitment to transatlantic relationship is going to remain strong. The U.S. commitment to NATO is going to remain strong. And again, I do not anticipate any substantial changes vis-a-vis the U.S. foreign policy towards Europe and towards NATO. I do want to point out to your audience that, unfortunately, Greece is still in a recession. What Greece needs today is a pro-business, pro-reform government that will attract foreign investment, that will leverage the country's significant comparative advantages, and that will very clearly reinforce its orientation towards NATO and towards the European Union. And at least as far as the commitment to reforms and opening up Greece to competition, I don't think we have that government today. The end result is that we have an unemployment that is stuck above 20%. We have lots of talented Greeks who leave the country in search of better employment, and the general sense in Greece is that the country is moving in the wrong direction.
Do you agree with Prime Minister Tsipras that the austerity measures have been too tough on Greece and that that is a big part of the problem?
That is part of the problem, but it's not the only problem. Obviously, there's no doubt in my mind that we pushed austerity too far, and part of the blame also needs to be placed on our creditors. But if we want to convince our creditors that a slightly looser fiscal policy is necessary, we also need to keep our end of the bargain. That means we need a more open economy, an economy that will attract more tourists, that will attract more foreign investment, that will be more export-oriented. Greece is a rich country with a very rich culture and with very, very talented people. My argument is that it has been let down by its political elites, especially by Mr. Tsipras and his government.
And how do you stop those talented people from leaving in the meantime as you try to right the ship on the economy? How do you keep more intelligent Greeks from deciding they're better off elsewhere?
Only by creating more jobs in Greece. And those jobs are not going to be created unless we attract significant amount of foreign and also domestic investment into the country. According to our estimates, Greece needs approximately 100 billion euros of investment over the next 5 years. I'm convinced that it can attract these amounts, provided we have a government in place that exudes the necessary confidence to attract foreign investors.
What did you think of the Brexit vote in Britain?
Well, I think the Brexit vote came as a surprise for most Europeans. It does point out that within Europe there is a general sense of discontent with the overall direction that the European Union has taken. We do want to foster a new working relationship with the United Kingdom, but we recognize that this is going to be a long and protracted negotiation. But we also need to look into what is causing this sort of sense of populist movements within Europe, why the traditional establishment parties have failed to make a convincing case. What we're trying to do in Greece, what I'm trying to do as leader of New Democracy, which is, you know, a mainstream center-right traditional party, is to renew our party, to open it up to new ideas, to new people, and to sort of forge what we call the politics of post-populism. If you look at most polls, Mr. Tsipras's approval rating are pretty dismal. So I think people are already looking towards the next day. What is going to replace what I consider a failed populist government once it leaves power? And I think they will again look towards our party, provided, however, we change and we sort of acknowledge the fact that there is a lot of skepticism towards traditional political elites.
Do you think a Grexit is still possible, that Greece would leave the European Union?
No, I don't think that Grexit is in the cards. I think we came very close to a Grexit as a result of the negotiating tactics and the antics of Mr. Tsipras and his then Minister of Finance. No, Greece is and will remain a member of the Eurozone. What we now need to focus on is making sure that it is also a prosperous member of the Eurozone with a well-functioning public administration and a competitive economy.
I want to ask you about one more thing, a major challenge that Greece has been dealing with, which is the migrant crisis. Apparently some 60,000 migrants currently stuck in Greece. What's going on with the migrant crisis in Greece? How is it affecting the country? And do you think that it is finally coming to an end?
Well, we had more than a million people crossing the Aegean from Turkey, arriving on the Greek islands last year. Most of these migrants and refugees made their way into Central Europe. However, now we are faced with a different reality. Greece's northern borders are practically closed. And as you pointed out, we have 60,000 refugees and migrants who are currently stuck in Greece. We also have a European Union deal with Turkey that has been put in place, which has significantly reduced the number of migrants and refugees crossing into Greece, crossing the Aegean into Greece. And we have every reason to make sure that this deal, however complicated it is actually preserved. You know, having said that, one needs to make the case that when we deal with such a complicated problem, it is very difficult to ask Greece to address this problem on its own. There has been limited European solidarity. Very few countries have been willing to accept refugees from Greece as part of relocation programs that have been agreed on paper, but have been very, very difficult to implement in practice. Again, this is another example where the European Union has failed to come up with a common approach, and where sort of national political agendas have dominated the debate. But I think overall, Greece is recognized as a country that has dealt with this crisis in a very humane manner. A lot of Greeks went out of their ways to welcome refugees and migrants, but it is also very clear that, you know, our country has reached its limits and cannot accept more refugees and migrants. So we all hope that and work towards making the deal with Turkey work for the long term.
What do you think of the countries and your neighbors among them who have built walls to keep the migrants out?
Well, I think this is certainly not an approach that is in line with the values of the European Union. It is certainly not an approach that sort of adheres to the concept of a shared responsibility within the European Union.
That's Kyriakos Mitsotakis, the head of Greece's opposition party New Democracy. Kyriakos Mitsotakis, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
And tomorrow, the winners of the National Book Awards will be announced. All the nominees, jewels, but may we draw your attention to one. News of the World is the story of a 10-year-old white girl who'd been captured by Kiowa Indians in mid-1800s Reconstruction, Texas. The 15th Amendment, prohibiting denial of the vote to any man, has just been passed. When Johanna is released by the Kiowa, an old newsreader who travels the country reading newspapers to information-starved Americans volunteers to return her to family, a harrowing journey through dangerous, beautiful Red River Valley country. Author Paulette Giles is also a poet. Her book has been compared to John Ford's film The Searchers and to Charles Portis's novel True Grit. Some of the characters in News of the World appear in her earlier book The Color of Lightning. She fleshes out their story here in exquisitely researched detail. So what's true? Paulette is here, courtesy of her friend June Chisholm Skype, because Paulette broke her wrist recently and because, Paulette, where are you?
I am on a small ranch, 3 miles outside of Utopia, Texas, and Utopia is about 80 miles west of San Antonio.
Take us there. One of the first things we hear our newsreader, Captain Kidd, talk about is the ratification of the 15th Amendment. Where are we in time?
In time, this would be February of 1870, and he's reading from his newspapers to a large crowd in Wichita Falls, Texas, and it's raining outside. And listening in the back row is Britt Johnson, a black frontiersman. And Britt Johnson was the basis for the movie The Searchers. Hmm. But Britt Johnson was a real person, and he was the original searcher. His two children and his wife were taken captive by the Kiowa and the Comanche. And he went alone into Indian territory and got them back. And I wrote a novel about Britt called The Color of Lightning.
This is what we feel reading this book. These are real people.
Britt was real. There really was a Captain Kidd who traveled from place to place in North Texas, reading from newspapers from distant places. I put him in Color of Lightning, but he was so good, I thought he needed a novel of his own. And also during Color of Lightning, I researched captives and captive psychology and what happened to the children who were returned or not returned. And that in itself is a really fascinating subject.
Well, and you point us to one of the books you read, Scott Freck's The Captured. No matter how little time they spent with Native Americans, they didn't want to leave.
Yes. Many of these children had a really hard time readjusting when they came back. They feared roofs. They were afraid of enclosed spaces. They had become completely Indian or Native American. They had forgotten their own language. They had forgotten how to use a knife and fork. And they had become completely integrated into Native American society. And so when they were returned, they never quite readjusted.
Right. This applies to this young girl that Captain Kidd is trying to bring home. And you say in your note from the author, I think the words of my Irish character, Doris Dillon, best expressed how these children were. She says that the young girl that, again, Captain Kidd's trying to return is like a fairy person from the Glamoury, not one thing or another. Angorta Moore.
Angorta Moore means the great death. And that was during the Irish potato famine, when so many children died or came very, very close to death, that they saw the other side and they never quite came back.
Yeah. She says when they come back, they were unfinished. They are forever falling. did you read somebody, you know, in history saying that of these children? Or is this the poet?
No, I made it up.
Oh, you made it up. Well, I was going to say, is this the poet in you, Paulette Giles?
Well, the basis of poetry is the phrase, not the sentence. So when you move to prose, the basis of prose is, in fact, the sentence, if you stick to it. I have sort of refused to stick to that rule and have gone back that the basis of expression and communication is within the phrase.
Can you give us an example? I know you have the book there. Can you give us an example of a couple of these beautiful sentences?
Well, I will sort of thrash around here in the book. They passed a farmhouse set back among trees. The farm buildings appeared to be great dozing animals that had gathered near the house in the night, and there was a light shining in a window. Somebody was waiting up for somebody.
Somebody's waiting up for somebody.
I think it gets down to an old man who is determined to protect a young girl, even though he knows he's elderly. There's dangers in the way. This is a story about honor and courage. She was basically raised by the Kiowa, so yeah. Her highest value was courage. And he's a man of honor, which is the only way you can get through a lawless society. When a society is without laws, like Texas was at that time, honor matters, because it means you will do what you say you're going to do. And so that's what the story is about, really. And protecting children, protecting them and keeping them from harm. And he knows this is the right thing to do, and he's determined to do it if he dies in the attempt.
That's Paulette Giles. The book is News of the World. It's been nominated for a National Book Award. It is, Paulette, just a lovely, lovely read. Thank you so much for talking to us about it.
Thank you for liking it, Robin. I appreciate it.
And we'll have an excerpt at hereandnow.org. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.